What? What? What?
I know how we can run everybody out of Rock Ridge.
How?
We'll kill the firstborn male child in every household.
Too Jewish.
Shalom, and welcome to the Too Jewish Radio Show with Rabbi Sam Kohan and friends, a weekly serving of everything Jewish. We'll have a great hour together of news, music, comedy, and conversation. Our guest this morning on Too Jewish is Rabbi David Zaslow, author of the new book, Reimagining Exodus, A Story of Freedom. We'll also have visits from our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price, our Too Jewish Mavina on Israel, Oshrat Borel, and our Shinshinim Bar El Chahar and Leah Avuno, and our Maven on Jewish Education, John Ben Asher. Please email your comments to us at TooJewishRadio18@gmail.com or visit us on the web at TooJewishRadio.com. And now, here's Rabbi Sam Kohan and Too Jewish.
Shalom. The great springtime festival of freedom, Passover, begins tomorrow night. And like all Jewish holidays, it has some depth and complexity to it. Passover actually has four official names in Jewish tradition. Pesach, or Passover, of course, for the Paschal offering, the lamb that was sacrificed and roasted in the days of the Bible and the temple in Jerusalem. Chag HaMatzot, the second name, the holiday of Matzah, the unleavened bread we eat for the week of Passover. Chag HaAviv, the springtime festival, probably the oldest name of Pesach. And most thematically, Zman Cherutenu, the season of our freedom. Each of these names is interesting in and of itself. The word Pesach comes from the word for leaping or jumping in Hebrew, an apt description of the ways young lambs leap and cavort in the fields. The use of this animal for the sacrifice of the Passover reminds us as well that the angel of death leaped over the homes of the Israelites while striking down the firstborn of the Egyptians. It also refreshes for us the memory of the leaping joy of freedom, the ability to move and act as we wish that's prevented during slavery. Free people can cavort, skip, dance, or jump as they please. Slaves jump to somebody else's command. Hence, Chag HaPesach, the holiday of skipping. The next name for Passover is Chag HaMatzot, the festival of the poor man's bread, matzah. Unleavened bread made with flour and water in 18 minutes or less, baked quickly and simply. The food that our ancestors made is preparation for a hasty journey in flight. Of course, on Pesach, we eat matzah all week, and therefore we do not eat any chametz, best described as the opposite of matzah, anything made with leavening or fermentation. No bread, no beer, and lots of matzah, and other dishes made out of matzah, like kugel or matzah brei. It also means that after 7 days of matzah, we really understand why it's called lechem oni, the bread of affliction. The third name for this festival is Chag HaAviv, holiday of the spring. Undoubtedly, there was a springtime festival observed long before the events of the Exodus led to the creation of the holiday of Passover. Spring is celebrated in every culture and nearly every religion, and Judaism is no different. In our Seder celebrations, the orderly meal we will hold the first two nights of Pesach, tomorrow night and Tuesday this coming week, we teach the meaning and story of freedom in a rich and wonderful variety of ways. Spring is featured in the green vegetables we'll dip in salt water, in the hard-boiled egg that symbolizes the rebirth of spring. The magnificent love poem, Shir HaShirim, the Song of Songs, is chanted Saturday on the intermediate Sabbath of Passover, and it's filled with images of gardens and growth of love in the flowering springtime, a wonderful way to celebrate this most beautiful and verdant of seasons. Finally, the ultimate theme of Passover is freedom, Zman Cherutenu, the time of liberation. It is this essential ideal that's woven all through the week of Passover, central focus on God's gift of liberty that has made Pesach the model freedom festival for the whole world. Behold, or vador chayav adam lirot et atzmo ki'ilu hu yatzah mi-mitzrayim. In each generation, every one of us is obligated to see ourselves as though we personally had been brought out of Egypt. In addition to our own celebration of our ancestors' freedom, we learn compassion and empathy. For when we view ourselves as survivors of slavery, we are compelled to sympathize with the dispossessed. This is a central principle of Jewish belief and practice. Now, back to that second name, Chag HaMatzot, the holiday of matzah. In the spirit of a holiday that is both profoundly serious, what can be more powerful than celebrating freedom from oppression and praying for the liberation of the enslaved all around the world, but is also fun and sometimes silly? Here's one of my favorite takes on just what eating matzah is really like. It's from the Smooth E, Eric Schwartz.
I feel like a freak, cause every time I pull out something to eat, but it's weak, I can't do this, cause I'm Jewish, and I can't eat bread. Yeah, my rabbi said only matzah. Any way you wanna eat it, cold or hot, it's matzah. Fun for your mother, brother, sister, father, matzah. Buy in bulk for a lower cost per box, it's matzah, 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 matzah. Hanukkah, no, that's over, so you don't get passed over. Get your ass over till my pad is Passover. I'm the mad flow, a smoothie teeming with the jibbing jabbing. If you want the story of Passover, rent the Ten Commandments, starring Charlton Heston. But I got a question about the bread that is unleavened, causing indigestion. Call matzah. Eat it for a week, we got stuff. No bread, no pasta. Best believe a Jew is stopped up. Now Moses made the matzah when he was fleeing Egypt. Had no time for bread to rise, he said, I just leave it. We can eat it like this, feed it to the Hebrews. But little did he know that the weight would end up equal. Cause
let my people go
became the anthem. Get your damn hands up, maybe it will help you pass some. How could one bread rock is so famous when the taste is the same flavor of the box it came in?
Matzah.
Eat it at once, ain't no second guessing.
Matzah.
Leaving crumbs on my lap and chest, and it's called
matzah.
I found the Afikoman in my small intestine.
Matzah, 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 matzah.
That was Eric Schwartz, hip-hop rapping about matzah on Passover, the bread of affliction we're commanded to eat this coming week. Actually, at the Seders we celebrate, tomorrow night and Tuesday night, we are each supposed to eat a whole sheet of matzah. That's that square you get to fulfill the commandment to eat unleavened bread as our ancestors did. It's that much that's the minimum. You know, a couple of years ago, I had the remarkable privilege of celebrating Pesach and attending Seder in Cuzco, Peru. You might expect there wouldn't be many Jews there, but in fact, Peru is on the post-Israeli army backpacker circuit. There were over 1,000, mostly young people, at the Seder I went to in Cuzco. 500 millennials in two shifts each, singing Passover prayers and songs, drinking much too sweet kosher wine, eating matzah and maror and the full kosher for Passover meal. Truly, Jews everywhere experience Passover simultaneously, rejoicing in this wonderful season of freedom. And only have to eat matzah for one whole week, coming up soon. Our guest this morning, Rabbi David Zaslow, is the author of the new book, Reimagining Exodus, A Story of Freedom. It could not come out at a more perfect moment, just before Pesach. Find out what it means to reimagine the Exodus when we come back in a moment here on Too Jewish.
Hi, Doris. How are you?
Well, Carol, to be honest, now that I'm a little older, I can't get out as much as I'd like. I miss seeing people.
Why don't you come over to my place for lunch on us? The food's delicious. So many choices. And I have a special table with my friends every day. They'd love to have you join us.
Is there much to do there?
There are lots of activities every day. Mondays is Mahjong. Tuesdays, I do yoga. Wednesdays, we go shopping or to the museum or a restaurant. Thursdays, my exercise class. There are book groups, speakers, Shabbos services, concerts, a game room. I'm busier than ever.
Where do you live?
I'm at Handmaker. And the people are great. Please come over for lunch. You'll love it. It's even kosher. Just call me at 322-7035.
Handmaker Jewish Services for the Aging offers the full spectrum of quality senior living and post-hospital rehabilitative care. Call 322-7035. Handmaker for life. 322-7035.
Hi, my name is Lauriella, and I'd like to tell you how you can help send children like me to a Jewish day school at no cost to you. Arizona allows its taxpayers to receive a tax credit for payments made to recognized school tuition organizations such as JETCO. JETCO is the only tuition organization solely dedicated to Jewish education in Tucson. JETCO provides scholarships to children who attend qualified private schools like Congregation Anshai Israel's Kindergarten and Tucson Hebrew Academy, which educates students from grades K through 8th. You may give up to $1,087 for single tax filers and $2,173 for married couples who file jointly. Jewish education nurtures Jewish identity for generations of students like me, so please go online and visit our website at www.jetco.org or give JETCO a call at 647-8442. Again, that's 647-8442. And tell them Lauriella sent you.
We are delighted to welcome the two Jewish art guests this morning. Rabbi David Zaslow is the author of the new book, Reimagining Exodus, A Story of Freedom. I can't think of a better time to talk about that, or maybe a better book to introduce and explore those ideas. Good morning and welcome back to Two Jewish.
Good morning, Rabbi Sam. It's great to be here with you.
It's great to have you here. So why write about Exodus? You know, it has been written about once or twice before.
Yes, it has. But, you know, it's so interesting because, of course, our story, the Jewish story of Exodus, really begins way before the actual Exodus. It begins, I don't know where to begin it, but let's say at the burning bush when Moses has his awakening and his call to go to Pharaoh and say, "Let my people go." A lot of people don't quite realize or recognize. We've been so influenced by Cecil B. DeMille's depiction of the Exodus, where Charlton Heston was so far distant from Yul Brynner, from the, playing the Pharaoh, that they you know, it was like the shepherd going to the king. But really, they were raised together as stepbrothers. Disney has a great movie called Prince of Egypt, and it's about Moses. And so a lot of Jews have a misconception about the story itself. And then when it comes to the actual story of the Exodus, I still hear Jewish people saying, well, we wandered in the desert for 40 years. And the reality is it wasn't a desert. It was called the Arabah, it was a high plains, much like New Mexico, maybe where you are.
Kind of like Arizona. Parts of it look like the Sinai, for sure.
And you can actually have, you can have sheep and you can have flocks there of animals. And they weren't wandering. They were journeying. They were trying to figure out how to get back into the promised land. And, of course, the irony was is that they were not wandering around. They were actually, according to Rashi, Nachmanides, Maimonides, they were actually stationed in 42 campsites for over a year, an average about a year each in each of the campsites, with the exception of the first and the last year. But they were really very stationary camping. The distances between the campsites that are listed in the Book of Numbers, Bamidbar, chapter 33, is only about 10 miles apart. So I wrote it for Jewish people to break up misconceptions about the Exodus.
We are about to plunge into Passover yet again, in which we talk about the Seder and the Haggadah, but it's really about freedom. That narrative story, did it change for you in writing the book?
It really did. I wrote it, I published it with a Christian publisher because Christians, just like the Exodus, is our master story in Judaism, right? It's our core story. You know, everything we do is a reminder of the Exodus from Egypt. Well, in Christianity, it's not quite the full Exodus, but it's the Passover. In fact, Easter in Christianity, in Eastern Orthodox churches, they don't even call it Easter. They call it Pascha. And Pascha right. is the Greek term for Pesach. So it is really their core story as well. And in Christianity, of course, they're looking for liberation from sin. In Judaism, we're looking for emancipation from oppressive political forces. So to us, it's a very political story. Christianity, it's a very spiritual story. And there's a bridge there. It's two different stories, but they're harmonious to each other.
We will talk much more with Rabbi David Zaslow. His book is Reimagining Exodus, A Story of Freedom, a very interesting and provocative look at this central story of Judaism when we come back in a moment here on Two Jewish.
If you or a loved one is dealing with a cancer diagnosis, managing the healthcare maze might be one of the hardest things you ever do. We're Advocation Services. Private patient advocates serving Tucsonians living with cancer. We focus on helping you while you focus on getting better. Visit us at advocationservices.com or call us at 616-0005.
If you have a question, comment, compliment, or criticism, a kvetch or a kvel, please email us at twojewishradio18@gmail.com. That's twojewishradio18@gmail. Or visit our website at twojewishradio.com. You can stream all past and present shows through the website or download us from the Apple iTunes Store as very popular Jewish podcasts, top 10 in America, according to Moment Magazine. As part of our pre-Passover musical preview on this final Sunday before Pesach, here is Safam's version of the Passover psalm, Betzeit Yisrael Mimitzrayim, when Israel came forth out of Egypt.
Betzeit Yisrael Mimitzrayim, Beit Yaakov Me'am Elohez, Haita Yehuda Likacho, Yisrael Mamshilo.
That was the Passover psalm, Betzeit Yisrael by Safam, for the first Seder tomorrow night and the whole week to come of Pesach. We welcome our expert on the international Jewish scene, Tom Price. Good morning, Tom.
Good morning, Rabbi.
Tom, I should also note you're also an enologist, a wine expert, and I'm a wine buff. Pesach is coming soon, very soon, tomorrow. And kosher for Pesach wine is always an interesting question for people. It used to be, okay, get Manischewitz or Mogen David and you're done. But now, of course, there's very good kosher dry wines produced all over the world. And maybe we can do a little bit of an exploration of that.
Right. I have to say, I'm more of an expert on wines, which I'm not a great expert, but I'm more of an expert on wines than I am about what makes a wine kosher or kosher Pesach or whatever. We're going to turn to you for that. But it's true that when we were kids, it was like Mogen David or Manischewitz, and it was horribly sweet, and nobody was going to become an alcoholic from drinking that.
They might get diabetes, but not alcoholism.
Right. And now, and that actually was never the case in France. In countries where wine is an important part of the culture, hundreds of wineries have rabbinic supervision and produce kosher wine. So if you're in France and you go to a kosher restaurant in any big city, you can get a wine list with 200 or 300 types of wine that are all kosher and all produced in France, and including some very, very good ones. To a lesser extent, but still to an important extent, that's true in other wine-producing countries like Italy, Australia, Chile, Argentina, New Zealand even. There's a variety of kosher wines, and the question is, and I don't know the answer, so I'm asking this
probably
in a genuine
Israel,
way.
Israel, you can get some pretty good kosher wines.
Right, and some pretty good non-kosher wines, mm-hmm. and some pretty bad wines in each category as well. it's across the board. But, you know, I think it might be interesting for your listeners to know, like, does a rabbi or a mashgiach or somebody with some certification have to be on the premises at all time
right,
for wine to be kosher?
Yeah.
And what's the difference between ordinarily kosher wine and wine that's kosher for Passover? I mean, these are all questions that I think might be of interest, particularly now as we're approaching Passover.
Right. I mean, so the short answer, and there is a long, long answer, but the short answer is, unlike, say, you know, shmura matzah, where you have to watch the field while the wheat is growing to make sure nothing happens that might somehow cause fermentation, grapes are grapes. They're grown. They can be harvested. If it's kosher wine, you don't want them to be harvested on Shabbat, so there may be some supervision for that, and there's a variation.
Wait, but question right away. I mean, if you go to the grocery store and buy grapes,
right,
or any other fruit,
well, you don't know when,
you
they,
don't
were
know when they were harvested. That's and there's correct. no so, question of, so are these fruits kosher?
That's correct. So I would say, generally speaking, the time when a wine is kosher or not kosher comes down to the period after the harvest, when you don't want it to be harvested on Shabbat. Now, again, we don't necessarily have any control over that. But once the wine is pressed, you want to make sure that no clarifiers are used, because in some traditional winemaking, they used animal products to clarify the wine, or they may have used filters to separate it that were made out of animal products. That's not common in modern winemaking, but it is still used in some parts of the world. And then once the wine is put into bottles, after all, it's just grape juice that's fermented to one degree or another. You can't have for Pesach wine that's fortified with grain spirits. There's a variety of different kinds of wines that are made that way to make them stronger. And this will be another session, I suspect. But there's also a consideration in terms of just how kosher you want the wine to be. And there are some people who believe that wine has to be boiled to be fully kosher. It's called mevushal, which some people think damages the wine, other people don't. And we'll talk more about those aspects next week.
But I look forward to it, because I have lots of questions, and I'll bet I'm not the only one with questions.
And I hope I have some answers. Chag Sameach, Tom.
We welcome our Shin Shinit on Israel, representing the Weintraub Israel Center, Leah Avuno. Boker Tov, Leah, and
Boker Tov, Mashlomcha.
Kol Beseder, Chag Pesach Sameach.
Chag Pesach Sameach.
So, how do you celebrate Passover in Ethiopia?
Okay, so when I made Aliyah, I was 2 years old, so,
so you
I don't remember
everything about Ethiopia.
Well, yeah,
of course.
I have a really good memory, but no. But some of the traditions still stayed with the family in Israel, and the first thing is that we're not eating chametz 9 days and not just 7 days.
So why 9 days?
Because people were afraid to eat chametz in the time that they were not supposed to, so they just said, "Well, let's just add another day at the end and at the beginning, and then nobody's gonna do a chet.
Nobody'll sin. Nobody'll transgress."
Yeah. Mm-hmm. So,
in a way, it's the same way that we ended up with an eighth day of Pesach Ashkenazic Jews and Sephardic Jews and Edot HaMizrach, all the other rest of the Jews.
Yeah.
But the Ethiopians are very careful. Medakdek, added an extra day, make it 9 days.
So we're not eating chametz from Yud Gimel Benisan to Kaf Bet Benisan. So yeah, 9 days. And
so the 13th of Nisan all the way to the 22nd.
Mm-hmm. And another thing is our matzah is really, really special. So the woman in the village, in my case, is my grandfather, my dad's mother. She will make the kita. The kita is the Ethiopian matzah, and she will make it like 2 weeks before the actual Passover. It's a really long process, and Ethiopian food is known by like a really long process. The traditional bread is taking 3 days to make.
Injera takes like 3 days.
Yeah,
right?
Injera is taking like 3 days, and like all the other dishes is like really hard to make. But Passover is even extra. It's like 2 weeks to make a matzah, just a matzah. So, but then we're not starving in Passover, so that's good.
It is good not to starve on Pesach.
Yeah.
Let all who are hungry come and eat. We say kol dichvi and yeteve yechol. But the matzah that you make, does it taste different from the matzah that you've had here in America?
Yes. I think the matzah in America, in Israel, and Ethiopia, it's really, really different. They're all good, but I'll have to go with the Israeli matzah just because, I don't know, it's so good with Nutella.
More?
Yeah, and it's also really good with Nutella.
Do Ethiopian Jews in Israel still make matzah in the traditional Ethiopian manner?
Not everybody. Most of the people are just eating regular matzah from the stores. But some of like the elderly community make the older, like the old tradition of Passover, of Pesach, so they will make the kita.
Do they still in Ethiopia eat a lamb? Do they still sacrifice a lamb and roast it?
Some people will. It's a really it's a whole new radio show. You need a radio show, a radio station
well,
about
the good
that.
Part is it's still Pesach next week since it doesn't start till tomorrow, so we can talk about it then. Thanks, Leah.
Thank
Chag
you.
Pesach.
Oh wait, another thing.
Okay.
The biggest Passover Seder was in Ethiopia with 3,000 Jews in my homeland, home city, Gondar.
In Gondar.
So, yeah.
Wow, 3,000 Jews.
Mm-hmm.
Now that's truly a Pesach to remember, a Seder to remember. Leo, Chag Sameach v'Kasher.
Chag Sameach, toda rabba.
And now it's time for an occasionally recurring feature of Two Jewish, our most serene Zen Judaism segment. What is the sound of one hand clapping? Much like the sound of a gefilte fish swimming. That was our Zen Judaism segment, a koan for you. Amen. We welcome our maven on Jewish education, John Ben Asher, head of the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Boker Tov, John.
Boker Or.
Chag Sameach.
Chag Sameach Pesach. Yes, it's almost Passover.
Tomorrow, wow. It's really, really close. All the preparations, of course, have been done. Well, they're not yet done, but we're desperately trying to get them done. So it's the ultimate teaching holiday. We teach freedom.
Sure is.
Any particular ways that you focused on freedom this year in your school and you think would be good for everyone?
Sure. You know, freedom is one of those great American values and also a Jewish value that's important to us as adults and is important for children as well. And there are many opportunities throughout a school year to be talking about that topic and doing activities and events that cycle around celebrating being free, living in a democracy, and also the responsibilities that come with freedom.
Freedom isn't just the absence of coercion. You know, Judaism,
right.
Chirut, and there's other concepts, dror, different words mm-hmm. that mean different aspects of it. How do you connect freedom and responsibility? Sometimes I think we as Americans have a hard time with that.
Yeah. Well, freedom is an amazing privilege. Sure, many will argue it's a right, but when you look at it as a privilege, then it carries a little more weight because with privilege comes responsibility. And so as we learn about things like decision-making, like making choices, voting, and thinking through our actions, our conduct, our behavior, how we interact with other people. You know, even though we live in a free society, it doesn't mean that you can really be free to do whatever you want, whenever you want, however you want. There are norms. And so as children are growing up, there are all those important obligations and opportunities to help understand how to make good decisions, how to conduct oneself in life, and so forth.
So when we say in Judaism, often freedom is the ability to choose who you're going to serve, that doesn't always speak so well to say, a 13 or a 14-year-old. How do you make it relevant?
Sure. So when we think about the reasons why we make decisions, a lot of it comes down to what motivates us and who are we serving? Are we serving ourselves? Are we serving God? Are we serving our school or our people or our community? And, knowing how you're making those choices and where you're coming from is an important way to understand how you discern your decision-making process. And, you know, there's a lot of conversation, there's a lot of support, and there are lots of layers and opportunities to help grow that thinking process with students through direct instruction in the classroom on lessons. At THA, we have a wonderful curriculum called Attitude, which is a values-based program teaching about teamwork, teaching about love, teaching about Torah, and other kinds of themes. So that's one component that provides opportunities to help children grow in those ways.
And, you know, a good way to think about freedom as a form of self-awareness as we get ready for Pesach. Chag Sameach v'Kasher.
Chag Sameach, everybody.
When we come back on Two Jewish, we'll get the old Jewish joke of the week.
Is your aging loved one unhappy and having a hard time adjusting to life around them? The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker may be able to help. TMC Geropsych specializes in providing short-term inpatient services for older adults experiencing behavioral health issues. Did you know that most people with depression get better when they seek help? With the right treatment, those with anxiety can overcome and learn to cope with their fears, and individuals with dementia can continue leading quality lives. Our team, led by a geriatric psychiatrist, brings expertise from disciplines across a variety of specialties to ensure your loved one receives the right diagnosis and treatment. For more information about our services, please call 324-4600. The TMC Geropsychiatric Center at Handmaker. Call 324-4600. Let's talk about how we can help.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
It's time now for our old Jewish joke of the week. Jewish humor, Bubby and Zadie New, brought to you by Too Jewish as a public service for this special holiday of Pesach coming up. A blind man is sitting on a park bench during Passover. The rabbi sits down next to him, takes out his lunch, including, of course, some Pesach matzah. Seeing the blind man has nothing to eat, taking pity on him, the rabbi takes a piece of his matzah and gives it to the blind man. Several minutes pass. The blind man turns, taps the rabbi on his shoulder, and asks, "Who wrote this garbage?" That was the old Jewish joke of the week, special feature of Too Jewish, just for you. You should live and be well. You see, the blind man thought it was written in Braille. The matzah... Never mind. And now a word of Torah. The Torah readings on Pesach are some of the most dramatic and interesting of the whole year. We remember the Exodus from Egypt in a variety of ways, in prose, in poetry, recalling the sacrifices of our ancestors, and in rituals that we still observe to this day. We use Torah during Passover the same way we use the Haggadah at the Seder, to teach, remind, and refresh our understanding of the great blessing and value of freedom and liberty in every possible permutation. Freedom is much too easy to take for granted. We must always remind ourselves of what a blessing it is. And we do so by celebrating freedom in word and song. May we always enjoy the liberty to do so in this society and in every society, and may others who are not yet free become free soon. On this last Sunday before Passover begins tomorrow night, and in tribute to the bread of very little flavor, here's the wonderful poet Marge Piercy, a past guest of Too Jewish, and our poetry slam this morning, her positive spin on matzah. Flat you are as a doormat, and as homely, no crust, no glaze, you lack a cosmetic glow, you break with a snap, you are dry as a twig split from an oak in midwinter, you are bumpy as a mud basin in a drought, square as a slab of pavement, you have no inside to hide raisins or seeds, you are pale as the full moon pocked with craters. What we see is what we get. Honest, plain, dry, shining with nostalgia, as if baked with light instead of heat. The bread of flight and haste in the mouth you promise, home. That's the poem Matzah by Marge Piercy for Pesach, which begins tomorrow night. When we return on Too Jewish, our guest, Rabbi David Zaslow, will explain why the Passover story is the ultimate expression of freedom and how its interpretation in Christian tradition is incredibly close to our own Jewish one. Find out when we return in a moment here on Too Jewish.
My name is John Ben Asher, and I'm the head of school at the Tucson Hebrew Academy. Tucson Hebrew Academy is a pluralistic kindergarten through eighth grade Jewish day school. We foster educational excellence through an interdisciplinary, integrated general studies and Judaic curriculum. We teach our students to apply Jewish values and learning to everyday life, enabling them to make their community and the world a better place. Our engaging, talented faculty ensure a rigorous, interactive, supportive learning environment. From the early years through comprehensive high school prep, children thrive in THA's uniquely enriching educational community and culture. Our 41-year tradition of excellence continues to produce highly skilled, critical, and creative thinking students with a strong moral compass and deep understanding of Jewish identity, traditions, and values, well prepared for the challenges to come. Tucson Hebrew Academy, thaaz.org, 529-3888.
If you or a loved one is dealing with a cancer diagnosis, managing the healthcare maze might be one of the hardest things you ever do. We're Advocation Services, private patient advocates, serving Tucsonans living with cancer. We focus on helping you while you focus on getting better. Visit us at advocationservices.com or call us at 616-0005.
We continue with our Two Jewish Update on news of Jews around the world with commentary.
In Jerusalem, the campaign by Sephardic Chief Rabbi Yitzchak Yosef to annul a divorce were blocked permanently last week by the Israeli High Court. The judges unanimously accepted the arguments of a woman with a comatose husband who was granted a divorce 3 years ago by a rabbinical court in Tzfat. The judges also ruled that the High Rabbinical Court, the Rabbinical Beit Din headed by Rav Yosef, was unauthorized to deal with an appeal that was filed against the decision to grant the divorce. It is unacceptable that a divorce given by a rabbinical court equivalent to a ruling in a civil court can be retroactively annulled, wrote the justices, ending this painful affair. The case involved a groundbreaking divorce ruling which raised a political and legal storm at the time. The rabbinical court in Tzfat, headed by Rabbi Uriel Levy, determined on the basis of medical opinion and visits to the hospital that the husband was permanently unconscious and could not freely give his consent to a divorce. They granted his wife a one-sided divorce, if you will, assuming that they were fulfilling what would have been the man's wish. Yosef expressed his opposition to this ruling on several occasions. Several months ago, he convened an unprecedented panel of 11 rabbinical judges, Dayanim, to discuss an appeal filed by somebody named Reuven Cohen, who had no connection to the case or the family, in an attempt to overrule the previous decision. The woman filed a petition against this appeal. The high court judges noted that the high rabbinical court had, without precedent, agreed to hear the arguments of an unrelated party. Deputy President of the Court, Justice Eliakim Rubinstein, noted that the woman had proceeded with her life, assuming that the marriage was over for 3 years. What if she had married in the meantime and had a child? Would anyone have had the chutzpah to call that child a bastard in that case? Wondered Rubinstein. In his decision, Rubinstein noted that the great and undisputed importance of finding halachic solutions to abandoned or trapped women, agunot under Jewish law. In a barbed hint aimed at Yosef, Rubinstein mentioned Yosef's father as one of the greatest of our generations, Chief Rabbi Ovadia Yosef, who did so much to help these women. I'm certain that this is the wish of every religious judge at any level. It was quite a clever dig. Rubinstein also wrote that it was time to end it. This issue is difficult on a human and emotional level, and aside from the legal issue, our heart goes out to the plaintiff who has suffered so much. First, when her marriage dissolved after her husband became a vegetable, and then over the years in which she sought to obtain a divorce, followed by trying to uphold it. The ruling indicated that this was the last. Let the plaintiff go in peace and carry on with her life. In response, the now officially again divorced wife said that we should thank God who has brought an end to my suffering. I thank everyone who supported us. This is the happiest day of my life. Attorney Batya Kahana Dror, who represented the plaintiff on behalf of an organization called The Dead End about Agunot, said, Blessed is God who releases trapped women. I'm happy we've reached this day, first of all for the woman who has gained real freedom just before Passover. She can now carry on with her life. I'm also happy for Judaism and the rabbinical courts with this groundbreaking development allowing the release of trapped women as a legitimate course of action. In other news, the reform movement in America called on member synagogues to protect undocumented immigrants facing deportation from the United States. The Union for Reform Judaism, the URJ, issued a resolution last week recommending that congregations provide shelter and legal assistance, as well as material, financial, or educational support to at-risk immigrants. Rabbi Jonah Pesner, a recent guest of Two Jewish who heads the Religious Action Center, implored synagogues not already aiding immigrants to start doing so. Today, we urge congregations to protect undocumented immigrants facing deportation by adopting a plan for providing resources, temporary shelter, legal assistance, or other forms of support to those in need, he said. There are Reform synagogues and communities nationwide that are already supporting and protecting undocumented immigrants facing deportation within their communities. And with this resolution, we hope growing numbers will join in this holy work. Also last week, the Union for Reform Judaism was among more than 50 co-sponsors of a Jewish rally for refugees in Washington. Nearly 800 people attended the rally organized by Hias, refugee resettlement group formerly known as Hebrew Immigrant Aid Society, whose representatives have also been guests of Two Jewish. And that's the Two Jewish News of Jews Round the World. We are delighted to welcome back to Two Jewish our guest this morning, Rabbi David Zaslow, the author of the new book, A Story of Freedom, Reimagining Exodus. He's also the author of the award-winning book, Jesus, First Century Rabbi, and has done, really remarkable work. In looking at this text about freedom, you explore it in a variety of ways. You kind of reimagine it, as you say, looking at it psychologically, as a kind of a combination in terms of how Judaism and Christianity look at these festivals, as we talked about a little briefly earlier. And then you get to a very interesting question of appropriation and misappropriation. Can you explain what that means?
You know, in every generation, our people, Jewish people, have reappropriated. We've taken our own ancient story of enslavement, and we've made it fit the times that we're in, whether it was the time of the Roman Empire, or whether it was a time in the Middle Ages in Europe or North Africa, as recently where it was prominently used for the Operation Exodus, of the Soviet Jewry movement was really themed. The theme was using the Exodus story. So we reimagine it all the time. In fact, the Haggadah has become, as you know, so popular. There are all different kinds of Haggadot. There are LGBT and civil rights and feminist Haggadot. And for every different possible cause, that's an appropriation of our own ancient story. Well, the story has also been used, of course, as we know, by other religions, predominantly by Christians. For example, the Puritans believed that the King George III, poor guy, was the Pharaoh, and that England was Egypt, and they were crossing the Red Sea, which is the Atlantic Ocean, and they landed in New Canaan, Connecticut. They were landing in the New Promised Land. And it wasn't just the Puritans. After them, there was the Quakers. And after the Quakers, it was the abolitionists who were trying to abolish slavery were really core based in the Exodus story, all the way to the Mormons and to the modern era of the Moses of our generation, which is Martin Luther King. You listen to him speak, and he speaks like Moses, and he uses the language of the Exodus. So that these are good appropriations of the story.
So, you know, it's a powerful concept. Behold, you know, gives a new meaning to Behold, Arvador, Chayav, Adam, Lirot, Tatsmo, Kiluhu, Yatsam, Mitzrayim. You know, in every generation, each of us is supposed to see ourselves as though we personally were coming out of Egypt through our own eyes. What's a misappropriation?
Well, the misappropriation, here's a good example. Let's go to the Puritans. They were really struggling for religious freedom. Beautiful, great. They use our story. Wonderful, terrific. But here's the misappropriation. When they got to New England and the East Coast, they believed that all the Native Americans they were running into were the Moabites and the Midianites and the Amalekites, in other words, the enemies of the ancient Israelites. The only difference was, is of course, when the Israelites were freed from Egypt, they were returning back to their ancient homeland. When the Puritans came from England, they were colonizing or invading a homeland that was already there for other people. So the misappropriation of the story is really the Deuteronomy text and the Joshua text, where they felt they had divine permission to not only convert the Native Americans, but also to fight them and to kill them. And we know about the genocide of many, many tribes, and you know, hundreds of thousands, if not millions, of Native Americans that were killed based upon or using the theme of the Exodus story to justify what they were doing. That's one, yeah.
You know, when I think about the Exodus story, going back to maybe acceptable appropriations, I feel as though, and I teach this in a basic Judaism class I do, in which I talk about, or we talk about how, you know, you have the Exodus story in prose, then you get it in poetry and the crossing of the sea, then you have it reinterpreted in Isaiah, and then it's reinterpreted again in the Ketuvim and the Psalms, and then it gets reinterpreted in Midrash and Mishnah and Gemara, and it's, we as Jews have constantly reinterpreted it.
Exactly.
And that's healthy, right?
Exactly. I think it's very healthy, and of course, just like you said before, in every generation, we're to see it in ourselves. I mean, I think it's not a coincidence that the great psychologist of the 20th century, the invention of psychology, was a Jewish invention. We like to go inward. We like to look at ourselves, so that at so many Passover Seders, especially in the progressive Jewish world, we ask ourselves, who's the Pharaoh inside ourselves? What is the Egypt we're trying to get out of? What is our wilderness? We interpret it psychologically or personally. I think it's really good, and I think it's really healthy when we take a look and apply the Exodus story to many situations around the world.
You have a remarkable personal story here. You quote Roger Kamenetz, a past guest of Too Jewish, I might add, when he met with the Dalai Lama and his goal was to create kind of an Exodus experience. Can you explain that whole story? Because it's a great, great story.
Yeah, it is a great story. You know, seven rabbis in, I think it was 1990, went over to Dharamsala in India to meet, not just rabbis, but Jewish leaders, to meet with the Dalai Lama, because he had heard that the Jews had a secret for survival in exile. So he realized that with the oppression of the Tibetan people and the occupation of Tibet by China, that many of the young Tibetans who were living in Dharamsala, but especially those living in the West, like France, for example, were assimilating, and he wanted to find some techniques for keeping the Tibetan youth Tibetan, to keep them in Tibetan Buddhism. So the rabbis go over there, and just really to make a long story short, you can read about it in depth in The Jew and the Lotus. It's a wonderful, wonderful book.
A great book.
Rabbi Zalman Schachter Shalomi, who is my teacher, recommended to the Tibetans to make a Seder and to actually create their own Haggadah, where they're telling the story of Egypt, so to speak, being the oppression of the Chinese, and telling a story of liberation, and then to finish their Seder with a, you know, lift their cups of whatever they were drinking and saying, next year in Tibet. And sure enough, that Seder actually did take place eventually in Tibet and then another one in Washington, D.C. And it's a beautiful application or extension of our story for another people who are struggling for liberation.
You have a really funny story about Yetziat Mitzrayim and one of your colleagues. Can you tell that story too? Because I don't know. Look, to me, the Exodus is not only a powerful metaphor and an incredible historical experience, but it's stories.
It really is. It's great. I don't want to mess it up because it's beautifully written. My wife actually co-wrote that story with me. She's a wonderful writer, Deborah Zaslow. Shelley Waldenberg, a wonderful Reform rabbi, dear friend of mine, tells a story that when he was a young boy, he would daydream, and his teacher would ask him questions, and he didn't know the answer. And so his grandfather said to him, look, Shelley, here's what you've got to do. Whenever your teacher asks a question, just say, it's a reminder of the Exodus from Egypt. So his teacher asked him a question, and he answered, it's a reminder for the Exodus from Egypt. And his teacher said, that's brilliant. Well, of course, everything in Judaism, if I would ask you, why do you wear a kippah? It's a reminder for the Exodus. Why do you celebrate Sukkot or Shavuot or, of course, Pesach? Everything is, why do we wear a talit? It's a reminder of the Exodus from Egypt. So
yeah, you can't be wrong. It's funny because when the Kiddush we do on Friday night, we say Shabbat is Zecher Letziat Mitzrayim, a remembrance of the Exodus from Egypt. It's exactly that. And that that is not what Shabbat is.
Exactly. And then we also say Zikaron Lemaaseh Bereshit. It's a reminder of, so it's very interesting. It's a reminder of the workings of creation and a memorial, a reminder of getting out of Egypt. It's almost as if to say, at least the way I interpreted it, there's not so many interpretations, but is that the Exodus story is hyperlinked to the creation story, that it's the creation of a new people. But the creation story is, in a way, it's cosmology, it's abstract, where the Exodus story is so concrete because it's dealing with people complaining and fearful, and they want to go back, and they want to go forward, and some want to fight, and some don't. It's a very human story. In fact, that's why it was so appropriately by the Black Church, by the Civil Rights Movement, you know, and so misappropriated, in a sense. Let's say some of our great, the American revolutionaries were phenomenal geniuses like Thomas Jefferson, but he was a slaveholder. He had no conception that as he was fighting for the liberation, you know, for the American Revolution and to develop our nation, that he was also misusing the story or not even getting the story that he was a slaveholder of stolen Africans from their homeland.
So I went up Mount Sinai, as many people used to when it was controlled by Israel, and you can still do it. You fly down to Sharm el-Sheikh, you hike up what's supposed to be Mount Sinai. And it's a very interesting experience to be there, even if it's not the right place. Somehow the Exodus always has to end at Mount Sinai, doesn't it?
Well, I'm not sure. See, I have a part in the book where does the Exodus begin? I bring it back right to the creation story. And where does it end? And I say, well, it ends at our Passover table. It ends. It's not over yet. It's waiting for this coming Pesach.
So you mean Cecil B. DeMille was wrong?
Yeah, Cecil B. DeMille was wrong. That's why you got to get Moses, Prince of Egypt by Disney.
It's pretty good, actually. The animated one is much better than that Exodus Gods and Kings movie with... put a guy named Christian playing Moses?
Well, it could be because Christ is just the Greek word for Mashiach. So,
right. That's a good Jewish term. What was the most surprising thing that emerged in creating your book?
I think how parallel our story is to the Christian story. It's like music harmonic or a harmony. The notes are a third apart, but yet they're different notes, but yet you can play them together and they harmonize. So even though our Christian friends are speaking about getting out of the Egypt of sin and coming into the liberation, the promised land of salvation, we don't speak like that. But that story harmonizes to our story, which is a bit more physical and political, of getting out of any Egypt, some whether it's a psychological constraint or an actual oppression from another nation. I think it surprised me how parallel the stories were. That normally we think of Easter and as, well, that's their story and Passover's our story, but really the two emerge from the same root. They both take place in the spring. They both, here it is. Springtime is resurrection. It's a resurrection of nature out of, so to speak, the death of winter is a reemergence and a renewal. Well, that's a natural story, and it's only natural for Christians to apply it in their religion, but for us, the Passover story has to take place in the spring.
I want to thank Rabbi David Zaslow for a great visit here on Too Jewish. The book is called Reimagining Exodus, A Story of Freedom, just in time for Pesach and Easter along the way. Where else can people go to find out more about you?
They can go to Rabbi David Zaslow, ZASLOW.com. I've got a book trailer so they can watch me for 3 minutes pitching the book. And, of course, the book is available at local bookstores, Amazon, or any of their favorite booksellers.
David, thanks so much. Chag Sameach v'kasher, Aziz and Pesach.
Thank you. Aziz and Pesach to you, Sam. Thank you.
When we come back, we'll hear about next week's guest and get a final musical play out on Too Jewish.
For 100 years, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery has been known for their compassionate commitment to all the families of our community. Known as the most beautiful final resting place in southern Arizona, Evergreen serves all faiths. Their experience conducting Jewish funerals, Reform, Conservative, and Orthodox, is second to none. From traditional services to the unique, Evergreen Mortuary and Cemetery offers the best. To speak to a family advisor, call 888-7470, 888-7470.
Thanks for being here with us this morning on Too Jewish with me, Rabbi Sam Kohan. Join us next Sunday. Here on Too Jewish, our guest will be international best-selling author Pam Genoff, whose new book is called The Orphan's Tale. And, of course, listen to all of our podcasts on iTunes or stream us from our TooJewishRadio.com website. Our playout this morning on Too Jewish for the upcoming Festival of Freedom Passover that begins tomorrow night, Monday, April 10th. Join us at Temple Emmanuel for a great second night Seder on the 11th, open to the community, but you better call 520-327-4501 quickly or go to tetucson.org. And if you are here in the Sonoran Desert, come to our Passover Shabbat Experience in the Wilderness this coming Friday night. Our playout from our Passover playlist of particularly pleasurable passages of Pesach song is from the CD Reggae Passover for the upcoming Festival of Pesach, Shehechianu, the prayer for all new holidays starting tomorrow. My friends, have a Chag Pesach Sameach V'Kasher, a happy and kosher holiday of Passover, a Zisen Pesach, a joyous Passover, and a Shavua Tov, a good week and a week, we pray, of matzah and of peace. Baruch atah Adonai Eloheinu melech haolam Shehecheyan v'kimanan v'hivyanan
Sponsored by Two Jewish Radio Programs, Tucson, Arizona.